This is a recording from the Massachusetts Software Council Open Source Summit, which was also the Software Council's Open Source Special Interest Group's kickoff meeting. The meeting was on June 24, 2005. The event was sponsored through the generosity of Essential Software, and the cost of audio taping was paid for by Novell. Software Garden took care of processing the tapes into audio computer files and uploading them to the Internet. This third file has the open source technical discussion. It features Nat Friedman, VP Engineering and Collaboration of Novell, and Miguel de Casa, VP Engineering, Mono Project, and co-founder of Zimian. They're talking about founding and running an open source project. It runs a little over 52 minutes.
I have the pleasure to introduce our next speakers. My name is David Patrick. I'm Vice President of the Open Source and Linux Group at Novell, the product business unit. I'm also a member of the advisory committee for the Open Source SIG here for the Mass Software Council. The next two speakers we thought would be very interesting to have more of a technical view of what's happening in open source. These are both engineers, hackers, people
Hello.
Who have spent many, many
Hello.
Years creating open source projects. And I had the pleasure to work with them when I was the CEO of Zimian prior to Novell. Two speakers, Nat Friedman and Miguel de Casa, both have very, very extensive background in creating open source projects. Miguel was the founder of the GNOME Foundation, which is a project to develop a desktop for Linux. He's been working and founded that some 8 years ago, and today we have thousands of engineers that contribute to GNOME. He also founded the Mono Project, which is a open source development platform for .NET to run on top of Linux and Unix, and has been very successful in bringing hundreds of developers and engineers into the Mono Project. Nat is also was the president of the GNOME Foundation, again has been working on Linux for many years also. And most recently, Nat founded the Hula Project, which is a new open source collaboration platform to create a new standard in collaboration around open source. And he launched that in conjunction with some folks at Novell, and we've already had hundreds of people contributing. So they have a lot of experience in creating open source projects. They're going to share that with us today, talk about technical approaches, how they build community, what tools they use, and how they've created successful projects in the past. So I will turn it to Nat Miguel. Thanks.
All right. Hello. Can you guys hear me okay?
Whoa.
I have a medical condition right now, actually, that I want to tell you about before we start the presentation, which is I was in Jamaica this weekend for a friend's wedding, and I flew Air Jamaica on the way back. They have a nonstop flight from Montego Bay to Boston. It stops in Philadelphia. And while I was sitting, and it always is consistently 3.5 hours late, as I was sitting there, the stewardess dropped out of the overhead bin a box full of rum bottles on my head and gave me a concussion. So I actually have a concussion right now, and I recommend you don't fly Air Jamaica. But I have a good story too, which is
the brownies are really good, right?
Yeah. If you, it's like they're just rum bottles dropping left and right. Actually, if anybody knows a good personal injury lawyer who's not a sleaze bag, that would be. But I'm looking for one within some integrity somehow. I don't know how that. Anyway. So we're going to talk about open source projects, how you kind of create them, how you manage them, what the mechanics are, tools and processes, really specific stuff. We're going to try not to get too abstract. Except I wanted to start, we've done this presentation before a few times. We've explained to people who aren't involved in open source how to create open source projects, and I had this new idea where I wanted to try to kind of make it clear to people who maybe don't think in terms of bug tracking systems exactly how it works. So I want to tell a little story first, starting in 1860 in London. In the London Philological Society, there were these three gentlemen by the names of Trench, Coleridge, and Furnival, who had recently written a paper together. And the paper was about inadequacies in cataloging the English language. And they listed 7 problems with all existing English dictionaries at the time. But the 2 main problems they listed were that these dictionaries were missing a lot of words, obscure words or old obsolete words that were no longer in use, were just not in many dictionaries. And dictionaries didn't have good dates or citations for the first use of a word. They were wrong, they weren't early enough. They were just inaccurate. So they created this project to create a new dictionary. They called it the New English Dictionary Project, NED. I don't think they referred to it as NED, but if you were an open source project today, you would call it NED, probably. And their goals of their dictionary were to be complete and to have the earliest accurate citations, right? So Trench was the... This is the wrong presentation. This is a good kind of thing to figure out early. Where did I put this thing? Okay. Sorry about this. So Trench was the first editor, but he was a member of the clergy and didn't really have time to spend on this NED project. And then Coleridge became the second editor. And they kind of, how are they going to do this? Well, the English language is huge. It has, by most accounts, the largest vocabulary of any language. So they decided they would divide the dictionary up into sections. And there would be, you know, Coleridge would be the main editor, but each of the subsections would have their own editor. So maybe the letter A would have its own editor, or maybe the letters P, Q, and R would have an editor. And then they would, in order to get the citations, they couldn't themselves read every book and find the earliest citations, so they knew they needed a lot of contributors. So they said, that we're going to solicit contributors. They published in academic journals their ideas for NED, and solicited contributions. And they needed a system for organizing and accepting all these contributions. And one interesting thing is that Coleridge, he did his first release very early. He released early. The first release of NED was in 1861, less than 12 months after they'd started, which, as it turns out, was a very good move, because Coleridge, 1 month later, got tuberculosis and died. But this is how they did it. Maybe you can't see this very well, but what you see here is an old white-bearded man in an office that's specially built with pigeonholes or cubbyholes. And what they did is they solicited these contributions. These contributions of citations would come in on these little slips of paper where someone had written the word, and they'd written next to the word the citation, where it was released, used, and then they mailed it in, right? And so they would organize, as they were going through a letter, they would organize all the citations in these cubbyholes. So after Coleridge died, Trench was busy with the clergy. That was our first change of maintainership. The second maintainer was Coleridge. And Coleridge dies, and this guy named Furnival, the third member of the group, takes over. He becomes the maintainer, or excuse me, the editor, right? And Furnival is the maintainer for 9 years. And Furnival was a dick, basically. I mean, if you read this about this guy in detail, he was not very nice to work with. He was rude to people. He had his own style. So the sub-editors for A, I, J, N, O, P, and W quit. they couldn't work with this guy. He wasn't very good at encouraging. He wasn't a good leader. So when that happened, Furnival resigned. He went on to have a long academic career. So at this point, a new maintainer named James Murray stepped in. And this guy took it to a new level. He built a building that he called the Scriptorium, with 1,029 pigeonholes in it, right? He had more pigeonholes than anyone else. He could get more contributions in, and he understood marketing. He knew that communication was essential. So he used not academic journals, but newspapers to solicit contributions. He took out ads in newspapers. One of the problems that he noticed was that under the stewardship of Furnival and Coleridge and Trench, the dictionary was mainly getting citations on really obscure words. So they had thousands of citations on the word abusion, which none of you have ever heard. And they only had like 12 on the word abuse, which you've all heard, right? So it's interesting. One of the things that happens in open source projects is that they select for fun. People do the things that they consider fun. And people were really attracted to the idea of uncommon words and cataloging those, but not as attracted to common words. So he solicited contributions in newspapers and said, I want common words too. And after about a year, he was receiving 1,000 slips of paper in the mail every day. So he actually, he employed his entire family. He had, I think, 10 or 11 children. And they all sat in the Scriptorium, which was this wrought iron building that he had built outside of his house, because he didn't have room in the place for kids. And by 1882, he had 3,500,000 slips and citations. So he'd gotten a lot of contributions by any standard, right? And his release was in 1884, so he took a long time. Coleridge was kind of this release early, release often guy, and Murray was a little bit more like, let's get it done. And when he released in 1884, they had done half the dictionary. They hadn't done the whole dictionary. Ned was still not at 1.0, right? And, you know, of course, this is the Oxford English Dictionary that I'm talking about. This is how the Oxford English Dictionary was started. I believe the Oxford English Dictionary is one of the earliest examples of an open source project. I also believe that it probably has some pretty serious IP problems. There's no source of origin on any of those slips that were sent in. I don't know, someone needs to create a foundation or something, and someone's going to sue these guys. So I think this story tells a lot about how open source works now. It's more hierarchical than people tend to think. People think there's this chaotic, you know, anyone can write to the project source code system going on. But that's not true. The role of a maintainer is very similar to the role of an editor who gets contributions in and decides what goes in and what doesn't. And the sub-editors for those letters, they're like Linus Torvalds' lieutenants, you know? Alan Cox maintains this tree, and we've got the networking maintainer over here, and Alviro's in charge of the file system. Those are like the lieutenants, right? Also, certain tasks are highly parallelizable. They can be done by many people. Certain tasks are not. Eric Raymond famously said, given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. And he cited this as the fundamental technical or sort of methodology advantage of open source is that you can have more eyeballs on bugs. Or you could have more eyeballs on citations for words. So parallelizable work is done well here. Just kind of say we're creating a dictionary. You know, anybody want to help out? You have to kind of create what Tim O'Reilly calls an architecture of participation. Create a system that people know how to plug into. So people know what they need to do. Screensavers are a great example of this, which I will not show you. But you know, Linux has hundreds of screensavers because someone created a plugin system for screensavers, made it easy to write them. So a guy on a weekend could knock off a screensaver just like the way a guy on a weekend could find the earliest citation for a word or find what he suspected to be one. So give people work to do. And open source does well with these fine-grained, well-compartmentalized, parallelizable tasks. It doesn't do as well with tasks with lots of dependencies that are big and hairy. And I think the modern counterpart to Ned is Wikipedia, which if you don't know about, I don't know what you're doing here. But Wikipedia is, awesome. It, 600,000 articles in Wikipedia now, 25,000 contributors. It's a world writable encyclopedia, and that's a graph of the contributions over the last 4 years or so, growing pretty quickly. So I wanted to use that anecdote as a starting point. Now, sort of in that context, frame our discussion of how an open source project is actually structured. So I'm gonna let Miguel start talking about some of the mechanics.
One thing to keep in mind about the Wikipedia example is that it probably exemplifies a lot of what people do in the open source community without being necessarily technical. A lot of the stuff that we do when we're creating software is by nature technical, so you have to understand the source code, you have to understand how to fix a bug. And Wikipedia shares a lot of the same elements of open source development, except that it's a little bit more open. More people can contribute to this. It's easier to start writing for Wikipedia, and there's not as tight control in Wikipedia as there is with open source. With source code, it's kind of a machinery, so not everybody can make changes to the machinery. With Wikipedia, pretty much everybody can make changes, and the way it works is there's a peer review process that ensures that the content stays fresh and up to date. So what we're going to be talking today about, we're going to give a couple of just the foundation of how we've built open source projects in the past. And many of these things you'll see are very similar to other projects. And finally, we'll go into two case studies. One is a case study of a project we started from scratch back in the Zeemian days. And the second project is an effort to open source an existing commercial application and turn it into an open source project. Right? So the first thing to keep in mind, what binds the communities together, what makes us talk to each other is the licensing. And it's probably one of the most important decisions that you will make with your project. If you choose a very restrictive license, people will not adopt the software. If you don't get enough rights, people will probably not look into your project, look into a competitor project, or maybe start the wrong thing. So you want to spend some time thinking about what is that you really need to require from people. Some people will say, well, this is like, for example, Microsoft shared source efforts are look but don't touch, right? And on the other hand, you have things like the GPL, where it's encouraged to make changes and it's encouraged to get these changes back into the community, right? It's not necessarily mandatory, but it's one of the options. Or there are very, very lax licenses that pretty much says, this is open for everyone, do whatever you want. If you want to contribute, that's fine. If you don't want to contribute, that's fine. So there's a wide spectrum of licenses. We all agree in one thing. There's a body, there's a trusted body today in the open source community called the Open Source Initiative, and they put together and they published this thing called the Open Source Definition. It basically says, for something to be considered open source, it has to meet these four criteria. It has to be, you must be able to use, modify, distribute, and redistribute modified copies of the software. That's essentially what it is. And you can word this four conditions in thousands of different ways, and that's why we have so many licenses. But this is the important thing, that you have these four rights, and this is what actually spurs innovation and gets people contributing. There's been a lot of discussion. Typically, there's a lot of discussion along the lines of the open source group and the free software group, whether we're doing this for freedom or we're doing this because we want better software. It is a lot more complex than those two things. Being involved in many major projects, we've seen every possible reason for people to contribute to. It's not as simple or clear-cut as Richard Stallman or Eric Raymond portrayed. There's a lot of people are doing this because it's fun, and it has nothing to do with freedom. It has nothing to do with getting working software. They're just enjoying themselves. A huge other component is the community ties. Many friendships have been made over open source projects, business relationships. I met Nat on the internet in 1996, 95. Because we shared a common interest in Linux, and then we went on and started a company, and now we work at Novell making open source successful. So, I mean, and it goes beyond that. Many people that we've met did it because it was a way of learning. Writing free software and contributing to a project was not something they were doing, again, for any of the obvious reasons, but because it was a way of learning a new technique. It was a way of improving their skills, right? And what is interesting is, in the end, we all benefit, right? In the end, it doesn't matter what your motivation for doing this as an individual is. As long as we can incorporate your contribution back into the main code base, we can unbenefit. Another key element, and I think one of the big things that plays a role is the fact that with open source, in the past, if you had an idea, if you wanted to make something happen, right? Let's say that you had an idea about a spreadsheet, or a spreadsheet didn't do what you wanted, but you would like a spreadsheet that did some kind of graph rotation, right? You basically needed to start from scratch and build everything that people expected. The computational engine, the printing engine, all the formulas, compatibility for loading Lotus files and Excel files and so on. And honestly, after you spent a couple of years working on your project, you actually get to try out your innovation, right? Or if you try your innovation early on, nobody's going to use it. So basically, in the past, if you wanted to innovate, you had to build all of this stuff up to this point, and then you can try your innovation up. The situation where we are on today is we're pretty much at the same level as equivalent commercial products for many domains of software, right? So if you want to innovate, you can take an existing open source project and try out your idea. If your idea is good, it will get adopted. If your idea has some merit, people will look into it, they will help you out, and they will integrate it into the software. Typically, people say that open source does not innovate, but it's because they haven't really, we just take things for granted, right? For a very long time, we've just been assuming that things that have happened have been invented in a commercial space. But I like always to remind people that the web was created as an open source project. So when it comes to large innovations, open source has a lot of these things. It doesn't necessarily get credited for all of its innovations, but there's a lot of them. Anyways. I'm going to skip through this really quickly. Companies and governments might have different reasons for working in open source. In the particular case of companies, and it's kind of a relatively new thing. It has only happened in the last few years. Some of these motivations were talked about before. We want to share some of the development cost. We want, for example, some of our investments to keep alive, and you can see this innovation where it's underlining the misspelled word right there. Anyways, some people wanted to do it, for example, if they have a null product and they don't want to maintain it, they cannot maintain it in the future. It's a way of giving customers a way or a path for the future, right? So companies have another different set of motivations which are not necessarily aligned with individuals. But we basically all come together at the central point, which is we have open source software. Governments, I guess you guys are familiar with that. Some people have small budgets. Some people believe that documents must be open for a very long time, and they prefer to use open protocols, open standards, and open source to various degrees to ensure that documents and information that the government keeps will be maintained for hundreds of years to come. And in a few cases, like for example, Spain and China and Brazil and so on, the problem that they have is they want to deploy a lot of computers, but they don't have a lot of money. So they just want cheap, right? In the case of Andalusia and Extremadura, it's interesting because they want it cheap, but at the same time, a side effect is that they created a local software industry in one of the regions in Spain where a software industry was just unthinkable, right? So people who in the past had to move to Madrid or Barcelona to get jobs, because if they were interested in IT, they would move to the big cities, now can remain in their hometowns, and they have created a little business there. This was talked before today. So I'm not going to talk too much about this, but we believe that Linux as an operating system is the first big product of the internet. Although pieces were done before, small individual pieces, really the internet got all of us together and made us create this thing out of the blue.
Just say that, I mean, you know, the open source is primarily a phenomenon of the internet. You know, when they were building the dictionary, they had the Postal Service to transmit all these slips around, but it was expensive and you know, imperfect and not instant. And you know, so better communications has led to this. So that's why Wikipedia is interesting, because it's kind of the second product of the internet, you know, from an open development perspective. So.
As you can imagine, we're really interested in wikis, which is this collaborative editing model. In particular, the two projects that we're going to showcase today, we've migrated all of our web content from traditional content management system into just publicly accessible wikis, right? So that means that it's actually really interesting, because one big problem of the web is that the content tends to get stale, and now we don't need to depend on ourselves getting all the work done. We can actually delegate a lot of that work to people who are actually trying out the software. So as a mechanism of maintaining up-to-date documentation on projects, wikis are just fantastic. And I hear a lot of people saying, but what if somebody comes and puts the wrong content in? And all this time that we've been under operation, I don't think we've seen a single problem with a contributor. But if there is a problem, you can click a button and it just gets the bad content out. I'm not going to go into this.
You say one click to get it out?
One, two. I think you have to confirm. The reason we didn't do one click is because Amazon has a patent on that. No. Maybe the most important element, I think, in a successful open source project is the maintainer. The maintainer is this person in charge of the project. Nat gave a beautiful example of what happened with the encyclopedia. You need someone who is responsible, that understands technology, that is fairly familiar with the inner workings of it. You need it to be a good communicator. If you're not a good communicator and you cannot present your ideas and you cannot resolve conflict between parties, your project is doomed. There's a lot of projects started in the open source community. Anybody knows SourceForge? Well, not anybody, but SourceForge has how many? Like a few hundred thousand projects?
100,000 projects.
100,000?
We just crossed 100,000.
So probably 10% of those are active. The other ones, there's either not enough attention paid to it, the person creating this project doesn't really communicate what he wants to do. Some of these projects are not really well planned out and so on. But the maintainer plays a key role in the development of any open source project. And it works basically like a little pyramid, right? Like Nat was describing before. You have somebody at the top and then you kind of break down all the different elements.
But it's an interesting pyramid, because it's inverse of the pyramid you would have in a company. Like in a company, at the top you have, you know, whoever's in charge of the development, and then you have maybe their managers and the various components. And you know, you mainly think in terms of things going from the top to the bottom, and you think of orders as going from the top to the bottom. Like, build us a great you know, web server. Okay, now you're going to go build, you know, this part, you're going to build this part, you're gonna, and pass it all the way down to the engineers. In the maintainer model pyramid, you think about patches flowing upwards, right? You know, you think about code flowing upwards. So code just sort of comes from people who have some motivation to produce it. They pass it on to the maintainer for a given section, who's trusted to handle that, who may pass it on to someone else, who may eventually, you know, the guy in charge may never hear about it, but it's getting into his code base. That's how the kernel is organized. Linus has his core lieutenants, eight or so, you know, who are in charge of large subsections, one of whom is in charge of all the USB drivers, and then of course there's a maintainer for each USB driver, and that guy accepts patches from people, and there may even be layers below that. You know, it may be there's the good programmer in, you know, in the college dorm, and then there's the bad programmer, and the bad programmer submits his patches to the good programmer before they even leave, you know, the dorm. So sort of inverse, I'd say.
Now I'm going to talk about that case study about Mono. What we did with Mono is this was a project from scratch, and I'll explain to you really quickly what it is. Mono is a, wow, look at the font. Mono is a development platform. It's a platform so people can build software. We decided to create this thing based on a couple of things. Microsoft had turned the .NET development platform over to a standardization body called ECMA, and it turned out that it was very aligned with what we wanted to do at the time, which was we needed better development tools, we needed to increase our productivity. We had just gone through an exercise, and I'll talk about that later, that was very costly and very painful to develop. So we wanted to basically address these issues and bring this best of breed technology from Windows to Linux. Today, Mono is a cross-platform technology, so the same code that you write today on Linux will work and modify it on Windows and Mac OS and Solaris and other systems. So this is particularly interesting because ISVs that do not necessarily want to invest in multiple platforms, right? The argument typically is, well, 90% of my market is Windows. I'm probably not going to get too much from Linux, so why should I port, right? So this is an interesting proposition because now we're going to give you pretty much this extra 10% market today for free, right? So one of the things that Mono has allowed is that it brings ISVs, people who historically have been targeting the major platform, and we've been helping all of these ISVs move their applications from Windows to Linux. We've only had the project out for a year, and it's picking up quickly, not only in open source applications that are being developed, but also commercial applications and libraries and components. Another interesting thing, independently of the ISVs, is if you have trained or you have expertise in your organization, the government, or your company that knows how to use Microsoft technologies for developing software, you can transplant all of that knowledge with a couple of twists from Windows to Linux, right? For example, you have to remember that pads use a slash instead of a backslash, but that's the kind of thing that you have to keep in mind. So we're making it really easy for you to bring your apps from Windows to Linux. And most importantly, we're not asking you to rewrite your software. We're not telling you, if you want to support Linux, you have to invest these many million dollars and you have to rewrite your software from scratch. Mono has a wide range of uses, from GUI applications to server applications to embedded applications. So it's a general purpose development platform. What is interesting, what really drove the attention of many people to the .NET framework and to Mono is that you were not limited to a single programming language. It's a platform that basically appealed to many people. If you like C#, use C#. If you like Java, use Java. If you like C++, use C++. And we'll take care of making all of these programming languages and libraries interoperate with each other. So unlike previous attempts where everybody was trying to create a platform around their programming language, this basically said, well, it doesn't matter what language you use. We'll let you construct your libraries or components in the language that you choose, and you'll be able to reuse components written in other ones. And furthermore, we're going to target any of the popular processors available today. So Microsoft today targets the x86 and I think Itanium architectures with the .NET framework and a couple of embedded systems. We target a much broader system, from the IBM S390 mainframes to Spark computers to x86 machines to embeddable strong arm computers, and Itanium is coming as well. One of the things that we did, and you probably cannot see it here, but when we started the project, we only wanted to do this component. We wanted to do mono runtime with .NET support, and this component over here, which was to build GUI applications, right? So that's the two things that we wanted to do at Xeamin, increase our developer productivity for creating desktop applications. We're a desktop company, and we wanted to make sure that those things were addressed. And what happened is that the community took it on. The community was really interested in this technology, and they started creating all of these other missing pieces. They created a compatibility stack that allows the Microsoft applications to run, but they also created all of these libraries that are specific to Linux. So integration with Mozilla, integration with Apache, integration with every open source database available. Did I say OpenGL? OpenGL, integration with our server products, Evolution, everything. So it has turned out to be from a small project that was supposed to do two components, now it has exploded into this massive framework for building applications. As I said, the genesis had to do a lot with the pain that we saw for building Evolution. It was basically, the problem was, how can we develop an application like Evolution, which is a fairly large application that does a lot of things, supports every conceivable protocol, and we consider it to have a very nice UI. How can we make, instead of one application in the same time frame, write two applications, or write an application that is more featureful, or we can do the same application with half the developers, right? And that's what the Microsoft.NET framework came in. It was basically, in 2001, when it came out, it represented the state of the art in terms of developer platforms. And it was and at some point, it was a bit sad that that we were lagging so far behind. And of course, it was something that we could not do ourselves. If we wanted to bring the framework to Linux, it was not something that that a little company could do on its own. So what we decided to do was to open up the development. We decided to have a core group of our engineers at Xeamin start work on Mono and invite other people to join us. So what helped a lot is that it was a challenging and interesting problem for a lot of developers, as I said before, because there were all these components and pieces. And finally, it's been discussed before today a couple of times, but since we had a specification, since we have a very good specification from ECMA, it was very easy to compartmentalize the development. So developers could start work on different pieces without even talking to each other. So the compiler people started work on the compiler on their own without even talking to the other guys. The virtual machine people did their own thing without talking to anyone else. And each one of the classes was implemented independently. And around month six, we actually put all these pieces together. And for the first time, Mono worked. But it was never tested before. So it was 6 months of building things independently, and we got everything working together. Just a couple of quick stats before we move on to Hula. Today, we've had something like 18,000 changes since our release last year. We're the seventh largest open source project. Roughly 350 contributors are involved in this effort. 20 of those are full-time Novell employees. There are 8 full-time employees from a company called Mainsoft, and roughly about 10 from other smaller companies that do not have a large, but they just want to fix a couple of things, but not necessarily be full-time employees. The Mainsoft people and Novell people are full-time employees. And on a given month, although the project has 350 contributors to date, we would get about 70 developers contributing. We do monthly releases, and every month there's a rotation about 20%, either people who are floating or people who come and go or people who didn't contribute. The effort of the Novell engineers is mostly on long-term projects, on the boring things, like Nat was saying. We do the boring stuff, we do the QA, we do components that either take too long, so the attention span of a contributor wouldn't be large enough, so we tend to take on the hard components. And we let all the fun stuff, we let the open source community have all the fun. So all the fun stuff, we let those guys do it, and then we put it together. How are we doing time-wise?
I think I need to move on to the
two. All right, so I'm just going to skip through this thing then. About licensing, I just wanted to mention this thing. The growth in applications was quite phenomenal. Applications built with Mono, when we launched, we had 4 applications. By October of the same year, a couple of months later, we had 9. And by February, somebody did a journalist actually put together a list of applications that were built around Mono, and the number had grown to 60. So in a period of 4 months, it really exploded. We're using it at Novell for a couple of applications of our own, but I'm going to let Matt.
All right, I'll just go quickly so we can leave a couple minutes for questions. I'm going to tell you about a case study which is different because it's not an open source project that we started from scratch. And in fact, the decision to start it didn't come from the point of view of starting an open source project. We were looking inside Novell at the collaboration market in general and opportunities that might exist in the collaboration market. And there's this thing called ICE, which you guys might be familiar with, Integrated Collaboration Environment. It's the Microsoft Exchange Server, Lotus Notes and Domino are the main players in what's called the ICE market, which is what most people use for their mail and calendar work inside a company. And Novell is a player in this market also. We have a product called GroupWise. It's third after Notes and Exchange in terms of revenue. And so the question was, how can we, Novell, take a leadership position in collaboration? How can we do this? There are two large entrenched competitors. According to what we're hearing from IDC, this ICE specifically market isn't growing dramatically. People have been saying it's going to decline for 5 or 6 years. It's never really fallen off the way anyone's predicted. But it is a stable and mature market, so what can we do? And our idea was to follow kind of the Clay Christensen disruptive technology model, right? Build a disruptive technology that would come in at the low end, not be targeted at exactly the same kinds of users as Exchange and Notes, but would eventually mature to the point that it could take over the market. And the other thing was that we knew that if we just tried to outspend Microsoft, that would be a challenge. So can we leverage open source somehow? Can we use community resources and get other people involved? So this was our basic concept. I'm skipping over some of our analysis, obviously, but the decision was made to do an open source / commercial model where you have an open source project which forms the core functionality of your product offering. And around that open source project, you wrap a number of components to form a commercial product which you then license, right? So there's an open source project that would provide, and our idea was that this project would focus on mail and calendar and being best of breed in that area. We knew there were a number of functional weaknesses out there in Exchange and Notes. They don't scale very well. You can only fit a few thousand users on one PC. They're not very fun to use. Users don't enjoy using them. It's difficult to schedule meetings with people who don't work for your company. You can't tell when they're free or when they're busy, and it's hard to coordinate that kind of stuff. The web interfaces are not known to be very good. So we said, okay, if we build something that's just focused on doing a great job of mail and calendar, then we have an opportunity to disrupt here. So our idea was to have an open source project with a commercial product wrapped around it. One option was to start from scratch, just build something from scratch. But we wanted to take a leadership position more quickly. So the other obvious option is to open source our existing product GroupWise, number 3 in this market, right? It's got 30 million users. It makes over $100 million in revenue a year for Novell. If we open source this, then our existing users would benefit from any contributions that are made to it, right? But open sourcing GroupWise was not really an option as we did the analysis. First of all, it's a large number of lines of code. It's been under development for over 15 years. It's basically done, right? So you come out with this thing that's done to the open source community and you say, help me out, people don't see the opportunity to get involved. They don't see the opportunity to become part of the identity of this thing. So enter Netmail. Netmail was a product that Novell had, a small product that was really focused on just doing mail, not so much in calendar. It's small. It was only 250,000 lines of code. It was written more recently, and it was written using Unix and C idioms. So to a Unix programmer, it would look familiar. It only had a few key developers, and all of the contributions went through a single person. Does that sound familiar? Right? All of the contributions went through one guy who made sure that everything conformed to a style and so on. The IP was clean. We knew that because everything went through this one guy, and it wasn't very old. And the design was fairly simple and easy to explain. It wasn't this enormous multi-server architecture kind of thing. So Netmail was what we chose to do. In order to release Netmail open source, we went through a process we called scrubbing, right? So we assigned a team. We developed a methodology. We had assigned a team to scrub all of the Netmail code. The first release that we did in February contained about 100,000 lines of code, and it took about 2 man-months to scrub all of that. And the processes in scrubbing were, first, make sure you own the code that you're releasing, right? Having worked in open source for a while, and now having worked for some time with proprietary software developers, I have to say open source developers understand IP much better than proprietary developers do. They have to. It's part of what they do every day. They can tell you the difference between a copyright, a trademark, a patent, and a trade secret, right? You know, go ask any proprietary developer to explain all that to you, and you'll be really surprised if, you know, so proprietary developers do things like they cut and paste code from websites into their products. So we needed to do a scrubbing process to make sure we owned it. We got some help from Black Duck with that, which was great. We also had to do a security scan, because if you write code that you don't think anyone's ever going to read, you think you can get away with things sometimes, right? You know what I mean? So we had to do. We didn't know if there were security vulnerabilities in the code or not, but we had to read it all and we had to scan it all, and we found some, and we had to fix them, right? So that was interesting. One of our engineers said after going through this process, and he was a proprietary software engineer, he said open sourcing Netmail has made the code a lot better. And what I found was interesting is we took these two proprietary software developers and we asked them to scrub this code, and you know, it's sort of, you know, you'd think that would be totally anathema to the way they think, but they were up all hours, they were in every weekend because they didn't want to be embarrassed, right? They didn't want to release code and have people look at it and be like, what the hell is that? You know, so they knew they had to spend the time on it. So this is interesting, right? We had to convert the code base to using open source idioms and tools. This was a large amount of work. The build system was this like proprietary build system that, you know, had been built by the engineers. It worked fine, it worked great, but it was completely unrecognizable to people who know open source. So we had to switch to using AutoConf and AutoMake and all the things that people expect in the open source world. We had to choose and document the style guide for the code, because if we're going to attract all these contributions, we have to be able to make them conform to a style guide. And then, of course, overall code readability becomes a priority because, you know, suddenly your code is not write only, right? The other key ingredient for an open source community building was to choose a maintainer. And this is the person, the main role of the maintainer is to make the go, no-go decision on patches that come in, right? He's the editorial guy. He's the guy in the scriptorium. So he, as a consequence, is going to have to build all these relationships with contributors. And we didn't think we could take a proprietary developer who had never done this before and ask him to be the maintainer and succeed. So we took someone who had a long track record of running successful open source projects that had garnered many contributions, a guy named Dave Camp, who'd worked before on the desktop, and didn't know server code very well. A smart guy, learned quickly, but he knew what he was doing in the community. So we kind of put him in charge, made him the maintainer. That was one of our key decisions. And you know, once you have a good maintainer, you finally start. So I think that's key. The other one was a good name. Netmail was not a good name, we thought, for an open source project. It just sounds like, you know, a product. So we wanted something simple, something memorable, something that you can spell and pronounce easily, something that doesn't include your company name. You know, so you couldn't call it the Novell Mail and Calendar Server, and like people would be like, "Yeah, man, I got a patch in the Novell Mail and Calendar Server." That wouldn't work. Red Hat's trying to get around this by naming everything Fedora now. Like anybody, you know, is fooled by that. Like, oh man, I got a patch in the Fedora directory. Like, okay, so you're an unpaid Red Hat employee. So, but we wanted something that was non-explanatory, but that was also catchy. So Apache, Linux, Mono, Mozilla, these are catchy names. They don't explain what it is, but they're good labels. If it's too explanatory, it limits what you're going to do in the future, and you don't know what you're going to do in the future because you don't know what people are going to contribute, right? We also needed a great logo. That was clear. We needed something people would put in their blog. You know, we weren't going to go out and astroturf the blogs, but we knew that other people could do it for us if we had a good logo. So, something good for t-shirts, use it everywhere. I'm going to use it in the rest of these slides. You need to have community forums. If you're going to establish a community, it's all about communication. These are some of the key things you need. You need a public bug tracking system. You need an IRC channel so people can chat. You need mailing lists. We created two, one for users to ask their stupid user questions and one for the developers to talk to each other. You need a version control system, and you need an anonymous continuous access to it. So you can't just drop code every night. You need code to be continuously available. You need an aggregator for blogs. If you go to planet.hula-project.org, then you'll see all the blogs of all the Hula contributors and all aggregated together. So if you're a junkie for Hula, you know, you can keep up on this planet thing. And then we also, you don't have to do this, but we do. We have a service where we have something called live.hulaproject.org, which is basically constantly running the latest code. So we have about 400 people who have accounts on live.hulaproject.org from the community who are testing it for us. So as soon as a bug gets introduced, we hear about it from these guys because that's their email address. The other key thing you need is an extremely low barrier to entry. This was a design constraint from the beginning. So it had to be possible to build Hula after you downloaded it, to build it within 2 minutes. That was a criterion. We couldn't take longer than 2 minutes to set up. So untar, make, run. Very few, very simple dependencies. Hula has no dependencies at all. So you don't have to go out and download three or four other things to get it to run. Again, we're using existing tools like AutoMake and AutoConf. Also, this is something that hopefully isn't a surprise to anybody else with modern development practices like Agile and so on, but your source code has to always build and always run. It can't at any point not run and be approximately usable. Your main tree of your source code has to always work. If it doesn't, then people will come in and be like, man, I want to contribute to Hula. I'm going to add this awesome address book feature. And they'll be like, oh, I can't get it to run. Well, see you later. And then they go work on some other project. So it has to always build and always run. We had a couple of proprietary developers. We had to kind of change their culture a little bit. Main problem is internal discussions that take place over all, you know, cue balls or in offices need to be moved externally so people can hear what's going on and participate in decisions and understand why decisions were made and understand the direction of the project. In the open source community, one of the things was, you know, we pounded it into their heads, you got to listen to the developers in the community, you got to attract these guys. We kind of overdid it. So like the first night of release, we had everyone on the IRC channel, and these like 15-year-old kids are like, man, Hula sucks because it doesn't do this, and our developers went off to go implementing it. And, you know, that wasn't important. You know, these people, so you have to, you know, eventually you have to learn who to listen to and who's just a blowhard. There's a lot of blowhards. Be ready to get flamed. It's going to happen. So people aren't polite in the open source world usually. And you shouldn't take, you know, rude email as a sign that you're failing necessarily. I think it's too bad that people aren't generally polite in the open source community. The Linux kernel community, Miguel and I talk about this sometimes, the Linux kernel community is kind of the example that people follow. They're rude on the Linux kernel mailing list for the most part. Not all open source projects are rude, but a lot of them are kind of following that example, unfortunately.
And in fact, we kind of advocate the complete opposite with all of our projects. That's because right. We dislike so much the being rude just because we're...
It's just a practical consideration of nothing else. If somebody comes in and they want to help and then you're rude to them, they're going to leave. Yeah. So
we actually advocate the reading of, what's the book name?
How to Win Friends and Influence.
How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah, so we give out copies
mandatory
of that to developers.
Reading. Not really.
It is awesome reading. So spend your first month, just know that you didn't get everything right. No matter how well you scrubbed and how well you planned, your first couple months need to be allocated for getting the things right that you didn't get right as an open source project. So that's what we did with Hula. We knew, you know, there were things that the community would flame us about that we couldn't predict, and we didn't know what they. One of them was that people wanted to be able to run our calendar without our mailer. We didn't guess that. Maybe we should have, so we had to do that work. And you know, people were kind of like coming in, seeing that they couldn't do that, and leaving all the time. So we said, okay, we have to fix that. Give people work to do. I mentioned this in the context of Ned and the OED. But you need to give out lists of small tasks to people, and if you can, you need to create an architecture for participation. There need to be development mentors who help people get involved. Here's some examples of architectures. So plug-in architectures are good. There's a way of adding a plug-in. Skins are good. These apply to proprietary software projects too. A modular design is important. People can add components and replace components. Test frameworks is good. That's one thing we're doing in Hula. We haven't done it yet. We'll see if it works. But we're going to... there's no great automated user interface testing tool for websites. You guys might know this already. But if you're building a web application, there's no good tools for testing that right now. So our idea is to use the community as our tool. And we're going to write a set of tests down, and then we're going to put it on the website. And there will be a system where you can test a Hula build, and you can check off the tests, which ones succeed and which ones fail. And when you do more testing, you get points. And then we're going to have like a ranking, like a high score thing. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of insane, right? But People, if you've ever heard of distributed.net and all this distributed computing stuff that happens, where you do like SETI at home to search for extraterrestrial life with a screensaver, people really love those rankings. You know, they vie to be the highest contributor of computing resources to those projects. So maybe we can get the highest contributor of testing resources. We'll let you know if that works. To date, we've had a lot of progress. We have about 900 registered people on hulaproject.org who are contributing. 70 are actively editing the website every month. We have about 40 outside code contributions, which I think is pretty good. About a dozen hackers have signed copyright assignment agreements, meaning that they are regularly contributing and they're able to, you know, drop code in at any time. That's pretty strong. That's a number of active developers. We have fewer than that internally. So all the support for Fedora, Debian, Ubuntu, and Windows operating systems came from outside contributors. We've also made some great progress in development. And I think at this point, we're definitely the most promising brand in sort of the open source groupware place. So we think we've made some great progress. A little screenshot. The idea of the strategy, of course, is that Hula is an area where we're going to succeed in mail and calendar, but then we can build kind of a stack around that. So we'll be the best of breed mail and calendar. But once you've done that, you kind of have to move on to doing other things. So if you think about Apache came out and they were the best web server. And now Apache is this umbrella project for many, many other projects. So they're doing much more than just a simple HTTP server. That's the model we'd like to follow with Hula, where we create a fantastic mail and calendar server. Everyone recognizes it's the best. And then maybe in a year or so, we can branch out and create other things under the Hula umbrella if we succeed. So that's it, I think. I think we ran way over. Sorry about that.
A little over, but we have a little bit of leeway here.
Are there any questions that we really should do right now rather than at the hour we have afterwards to talk about stuff? Any? Yes?
Yeah.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah, we heard
that.
Oh, thank you.
Sure. Paul Zoffis from First Technology. We heard about the Mono project, and we also heard during the day about Eclipse.org. Can you guys both of, can we get a comment about whether they're similar?
Eclipse is an IDE, and Mono is a runtime engine. So that's the way you see it. Mono contains the libraries and the VM, and Eclipse is an IDE. In fact, Eclipse runs on top of Mono. Mono was the first open source Java JIT that was able to run Eclipse. We run it through GNU Classpad, but basically Mono is language agnostic. Doesn't matter what you write, we'll run it.
You can use Eclipse as a tool to develop applications for Java or for Mono or JavaScript or whatever.
So Eclipse is an IDE. It's just an integrated development environment, but the libraries that you have underneath, the facilities for running the software are Mono. So they're fully compatible.
Is that the way the Eclipse people look at it also?
Eclipse needs a VM to run.
I'd like to hear from the Eclipse people.
Well, Eclipse needs a VM, right? So we provide a VM. Now, you can use Sun's VM, which is proprietary, or you can use our VM, which is open source.
Okay, so I think we're going to go. We have logistics.
I guess I'm the logistics guy. Thanks, guys. Excellent job. Yeah, really good job. Just a little food for thought, right? You want to get your teenagers involved pretty quickly here.